Your Majesties, Your Royal Highness, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for inviting me. I'm really honored to be with you here in this beautiful Royal Palace in Amsterdam, and thank you also, Joris Luyendijk, for the very kind introduction. Quite often, when I'm invited to discuss issues of climate communication with the leaders of newsrooms, of large global corporations or government agencies, two questions come up quite early. What makes you hopeful? And we'll speak about that tonight. And the other one is, what do we even call this thing, this fast, initially slow-moving and now fast-accelerating challenge we are facing? Should we call it climate change? Should we maybe call it global warming? Should we call it the climate crisis? The climate emergency? Or maybe something completely different? I sometimes use a placeholder formulation, not because it's good, but just to buy myself some more time to think. And I call it the climate question. Because what we have done with our climate mostly raises questions to us now, doesn't it? Very practically, it questions how we produce, of course, energy, how we store energy, how we transport goods, how we transport ourselves, how we feed ourselves, how we run our farms, how we dress ourselves and what our clothes are made of, how we build houses, how we heat them, and how we cool them. But climate change, if we use the word, also questions our own place in nature. And if you want to use a religious or a spiritual term, it also questions our place in creation. And it puts us under time pressure and makes us wonder what our value systems are and what a meaningful career means these days. Or, of course, something many of you may have faced, what do you say to the children? And for climate journalism, there's the added and very practical challenge of climate change not really fitting into the typical time frames of news journalism. Journalism is the only profession that is named after a time frame, and a very short one. One day, le jour, le journalisme. Of course, journalism also looks beyond the day, but typically no more than a few years. And climate change reaches too far into the future. India, China discuss net zero targets for 2060 and 2070. And it also reaches too far into our past to easily fit into journalism's preferred timeframes and its typical so-called news value criteria. What do I mean by that? Ask any seasoned news editor for the criteria by which they decide which story makes it into that primetime news show or that top slot on a website or on a newspaper. There are many more criteria, of course, but typically their main news value criteria will be these following six. Is it new? It's the news, after all. Does it affect our audience? Is it relevant to them? Is there a publicly known person associated with that story that makes it easier to illustrate and make it interesting? Is the topic simple enough that the news can be conveyed without having to explain too much of the background and give footnotes? And is it urgent? And, importantly, is there ideally an event this story can be associated with? And now let's run through one of the most significant recent developments of Earth's climate against these six news value criteria, and that is the recent and unprecedented increase of our ocean's surface temperatures. What you see on this slide here are the ocean surface temperatures. The thin gray line is for 1979 to 2022. And then you see this orange line, and right above you see 2024, the orange is 23, and the red line that you hopefully also can see from back there is what happened this year so far. That is unprecedented, and scientists don't quite know yet what drives this acceleration. Now, back to the news editor. Is this new? Yes, but not by the standards of news journalism. This has been going on for months, right? Does it affect our audiences? It sure does. Warming oceans plus a warming atmosphere lead to much higher concentrations of water vapor in the air, stronger rains and storms, as we will see in this year's North Atlantic hurricane season that will start officially in a few days from now. Does this already affect our audiences today, right now, we can assume that it will affect everyone when our planet's oceans heat up. But that may not be as immediate as some other news that compete with that story. Is there maybe then a publicly known person associated with this story? Typically not. Different from other societal issues that we all care about, there is a remarkable shortage of celebrities, athletes, artists, or well-known business leaders who want to be publicly associated with, to Joris Luyendijk's earlier point, with climate questions. Next criterion, is the topic simple enough that it can be conveyed without too much explaining? We maybe have 1.5 minutes for that editor. Can we give that to her or him? Yes and no. Yes, the warming of our oceans is mostly caused by us burning coal, oil, and gas, as you know. But what drives this unprecedented acceleration here is not fully understood yet. And of course, El Nino also plays a partial role in that. All right then, is it urgent at least? It sure is. But from a fast-paced news editor's perspective, it will also be urgent tomorrow and next week, because there are always seemingly more important stories, which is true. Of course, we have major wars and other pressing issues that people really care about, elections, and yes, even who won the Oscar or the Champions League. There's one news value criterion left then. Is there an event that this ocean warming could be associated with? And we know from very recent studies that journalism's preference for event-related news already leads to an overrepresentation of UN climate summits, of climate protests, and also of the what you could call the breaking news layer of the climate question, i.e. extreme weather events, and to an underrepresentation of the more systemic but less event-centric issues, such as our need to increase the heat resilience of our cities as quickly as possible now. So as you can tell by now, climate change is a process rather than an event. And yet this is also where the element of, let's call it, temporal contradictions or temporal confusion comes in now. Climate change or global warming is a slow process that has been in the making for decades, more than a century. But it also unfolds much, much faster now than any climatic changes us humans have experienced before. But, you may ask, what about the last ice age? Haven't we adapted to climatic changes before? Weren't they sudden as well? Yes, that is a very valid question. When the last ice age, or technically we call it the last glacial period, ended, our average temperature rose again. In fact, it rose quite quickly. But it only rose in increments of 1 degree Celsius over 1,000 years, which still, as you know, had dramatic effects for plants, animals, and us humans back then. The speed of what we are now experiencing today is completely unprecedented. We have already experienced an increase by 1 degree Celsius over the last 100 years, and most of that since the 1970s. And I think this is why the term climate change is so insufficient, so belittling, and not really instructive. Change, as we know, describes something that happens more gradually than these very fast increases we are now seeing. And we don't just see them in the ocean temperatures. We also see them in a sharp rise of overall atmospheric temperatures and concentrations of CO2. So these are Earth surface temperatures. And again, the red line is 2023, where already the climate scientists were getting really nervous last year, and you could see them talk to each other also on social media, trying to figure out where the sudden acceleration comes from that goes far beyond what you would expect from an El Niño cycle, and it just keeps continuing now in 2024. And the consequence we see as well, this is an increase in extreme weather events globally. Again, the trend line is important, not the microdata, but you see the trend line. This is a view only for the US that's coming from the insurance industry. These are only the billion-dollar disaster events by type. And of course, it is important, no extreme weather event is ever caused solely by climate change. That would be incorrect. What global warming does is it makes these events more frequent and more intense. And then, you can see the primary cause of these developments, which is, of course, the rise, the increase of CO2 in the atmosphere. And this is not the increase that you often see, that curve of the concentrations in the atmosphere going up. What you see here is the year-over-year jump, April 24 to April 23, or May. And the year-over-year increase is growing. That steep red line at the end is March 24 over March 23. So despite all our efforts, the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere is actually accelerating in its growth. This is the highest jump in March that has ever been measured. Enough charts, enough figures and grim stats. But if you put those aside, you do have to wonder, don't you, how did this happen? If you put the technical explanation aside of CO2 concentrations, how did it happen that we primarily, our group of generations, that we got to this point of rendering even some of our own common sayings obsolete? As an example, we all have heard the saying that organizational change tends to happen only at glacial speed. And I realized only recently that even the world's glaciers change faster now than most of our organizations. Of course, we know the scientifically correct answer, how we did that as a species, but there is a difference between knowing something and really comprehending something. Science communicators have long known that facts and figures only go so far. It sometimes helps to start an explanation or an introduction to a topic, not with facts and figures, but with what creates awe or wonder or fascination. And let me demonstrate what I mean by that. You can't see the air in here, right? Nor can you see the CO2. So let me ask you to just take a slow breath through your nose. And don't worry, this is not going to become a yoga session. But you can feel this cooling sensation, the air. And there's a miracle happening right now that you perform about 20,000 times a day, which is that your body takes some of that oxygen in the air and makes it yours and feeds it into your bloodstream. And you may remember from school that in the air, typically, there's 21% oxygen and 78% nitrogen. If you add those together, it makes 99%. And in that 1%, there is another miracle happening while you breathe. In our air, only 0.04%, tiny, tiny amount, is made of naturally occurring CO2, because CO2 is not the enemy. CO2 is good. And these few CO2 molecules, they allow us to live, because that sunlight and warmth that comes in, touches the Earth, wants to go back out when it's being reflected, slightly changes its wavelength in contact with Earth, and then gets held in by those 0.04% in our air, creating that natural greenhouse gas effect. Estimate in your mind how much colder Earth would be without those 0.04%. It would be 33 degrees colder. We would live on a snowball. In fact, of course, we wouldn't live. It would be minus 18 degrees Celsius. And as you maybe sense by now, once you have established that sense of awe and wonder and appreciation, you can have a different conversation then about how we were able to distort that very fragile balance by adding CO2 to the atmosphere that, in hindsight, and hindsight is always 20/20, really should have stayed in the ground. This is also why the arts and the cultural sector, this need for open imagination and free-flowing thought that is not only informed by facts and figures, why the arts and the cultural sector are so important in helping us navigate this, in establishing greater climate awareness. And not only would it be unfair to journalism to expect from it that it does all the heavy lifting in public education, it also would not be realistic. The writer and anthropologist Amitav Ghosh once wrote that climate change is a crisis of the imagination. And with that, he did not only mean imagining how dangerous and how volatile things could become now, but equally the act of imagining positive futures, new and more sustainable societal norms and behaviors, and yes, of course, technologies. And this is what the arts have always done in the past, in literature, science fiction, film, gaming, as Lisa Pack will tell you later tonight, theater, or music, in any art form, really. So one, I think, really important contribution the media could make and is beginning to make is to give visibility to those artists and cultural institutions who are already focusing on questions of climate change and, it is so needed, positive climate futures. There aren't many yet, but we see more and more of them engage. And their efforts are not only about art, but about widening our imagination and thus our willingness to engage with something that often is just, let's face it, scary or demoralizing. All right, so where are we? All of this was the discussion of the term climate change, and you will have noticed that the term really does not capture the enormity, the velocity, the scale, and yes, the danger of what is happening. Global warming is a bit more precise then, but it always opens, and the journalists in this room will be able to confirm this, it always opens the inevitable disinformation campaign or the door to that on social media whenever there's extreme snowfall or unusually severe or long cold spells, and someone says, see, if global warming was a fact, it wouldn't be so cold right now. But of course, on average, globally, our winters are getting warmer and they're getting shorter. What about the term climate crisis then? That's a pretty good one, right? Well, a crisis is by definition something with a beginning and an end. And unfortunately, no person alive, no matter how old or young, will see the end of this crisis or challenge, because as you saw on some of these slides, we now have left that era of climatic stability already behind us. That we struggle with what to even call this phenomenon, that we don't really have words for it yet, is only indicative for its enormity, right? Ludwig Wittgenstein, the philosopher, once said, "The limits of my language mean the limits of my world." Meaning, the limits of my ability to comprehend, to shape a thought, and then to act. Words matter. But sometimes it is better, more instructive, to be at a loss of words than to use words that underrepresent what we are now looking at collectively and as individuals. There will be a lot more to say and share tonight with you about the future of climate journalism, about reasons for hope and pragmatic optimism, about the climate communication of large corporations and governments, and also about some of the subtle and the not so subtle taboos that still exist in today's climate communication. I hope I was able to provide an initial stimulus and context for our hopefully very lively discussion tonight, and I look forward now to my conversation with Mr. Landeck. Thank you. Journalists organize themselves in many countries, creating self-help organizations where they invite IPCC scientists or universities to train themselves as quickly as possible. So that is, I find, very positive. On the audience side, you also see growing appetite for a coverage of climate change that is instructive. Whichever organization I've ever worked with in the media, when we ask the audiences, what would you like to hear more about, it is, what can I do? And that gives agency, and that understanding that you always have to convey the urgency of the topic, as I did, and also the agency, this is what you can do. Those always need to come together. If you only do one of the two, this is not impactful communication and not informative. We also see that, for instance, here in Europe, we hear a lot about climate fatigue, and this is getting so politicized and so polarizing. It is. But the DeLore Institute, for instance, published a study recently that the vast majority across Europe still want more ambitious climate policies, of course, also because we can experience more and more of these extreme weather events. In regulation, we see remarkable progress that really surprised me. I wish I would have known that earlier. It would have made me more hopeful earlier. There are broadly two or three themes globally. They play out everywhere, Asia, the Americas, and Europe. The first is that corporations disclose more of their emissions, so they know where they stand, no longer just your own emissions, but also the emissions from your entire supply chain, all the material you buy, and the emissions of the products for their entire lifetime. Countries such as Brazil and Australia will make that mandatory now, and that really helps to get a better picture. The second is that governments say, really wonderful that you have these ambitious net zero targets, we need them, but now we would also like to see your plan. What are you doing year after year to ever get to that target? So-called transition plans becoming mandatory. And many corporations endorse them. This is not anti-business. There are large businesses that really helped make that happen. And then the third is that carbon emissions are getting a price tag, which again is something that large companies have asked for, that they said, if I invest into this low carbon steel plant, I want to have some sort of insurance against someone else not doing that. And this is where carbon border taxes and these kinds of things come in. And then, of course, technology itself. It is remarkable how the technologies also accelerate similarly to that chart or those charts you have seen where, for instance, the price of solar technology has come down 85% in the last 10 years. And of large grid-scale batteries that are really important by 83%, which leads to curious effects that even Republican Texas now is the dominating renewable energy region of the entire United States because the economics are just so compelling. So those are some of the things that really make me hopeful.
Good, because now we're going back to 2020. So We're here to talk about climate and how to talk about climate to your viewers, your readers, your listeners, your voters, your consumers, your investors, your gamers, but primarily also how to talk about climate to yourself.
Yes.
How mentally to deal with the enormity of this thing. And so in 2020, you make this climate plunge, and we know each other from my time at The Guardian, and afterwards we kept in touch, and you would tell me these jealousy-inducing stories about what it's like to launch Vogue in China or to join Anna Wintour on some red carpet event in New York City. And then you take your climate plunge. And sometimes I check in on you and see how you're coping. And then in April 2021, you sent me an email that I will never forget. You've been reading and studying for a number of months now about how bad is this? And so I check in on you. And you write this: I feel like having discovered an additional room in my house. It is a room that is always scary to enter, and I can only be in it for a few minutes every day. The room has a nice view, it's tidy. In it, time stands still, and the truthful quiet is similar to when someone has just been born and is resting, or someone has just passed away. It feels that existential, and like death and birth, not really threatening once you're really close to it. Then you hit the return button and you write, my moments of fear happen outside that room. And so can you talk a little bit about what that was like?
Yeah. Whew. Yeah, I made a mistake back then. I thought, as a young man, I worked for Germany's national public broadcaster. I was a news anchor, and I was one night asked to review all the footage that came in from a battlefield, unedited. And so I have seen things in my life I wish I had not seen, but I also learned to cope, and I really trusted in my own resilience. And so I thought, I'll just lock myself away. Now I have time and I will read up on this climate thing that I've been working on professionally here and there, but never full time, which is, you know, as you do when you run a company, you can do that yourself. And so I locked myself away and I thought, I will read up on this now. And I was terrified when I read these IPCC summary reports. And I was also baffled. I thought, how could I not have known this, that this is where things stand? I was, you know, even at The Guardian together, we worked on climate-related campaigns even, so I was involved, but I didn't understand how severe the situation is. And it felt very existential. It made me question everything I had done in my life. I was the guy in the private jet, of course. But it also made me really worried about my children, and I did not know what I know now, all these reasons for hope, because I started with the science. I didn't look at what is happening. And to really be honest, soon after that, I thought, I want to get a new Apple Watch. Oh, I shouldn't, it's consumerism. Maybe I'll try on my old one again that seems to be not working. Let's just see how it does. And then thanks to that watch, I noticed that my heart rate, and I'm very healthy, had been far too high, so high that I needed to see a doctor. And so I was beginning to develop panic attacks.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a lot of stigma, and it's embarrassing to speak about that, but it shouldn't be. But I learned one important thing since then. When someone says to me, "All right, now I really want to learn more about this thing, what should I do? What books should I read?" I don't give book lists, I do, but I say, who will you do this with? Don't do this alone. This is bigger than anything any of us have ever faced. And it was in my training as a climate communicator a very important experience, because it helped me to have more empathy and to be aware of what I'm asking the public for, to become more aware of this. And different people respond differently, right? Some respond with aggression, as we can see. Some respond with denial or with cynicism or with doomism. But I would not have had the empathy to understand the human psyche had I not gone through that experience myself. And I'm thankful that you cared.
Huh. Yeah, it woke up a lot of kind of contradictory feelings, because on the one hand, I wanted to be there for you, but on the other hand, you would tell me stuff that would then plunge me into a similar abyss. And I think I caught myself having bargained with this. Think, okay, so there's climate change. Okay, so I'm going to have this really awkward conversation with my grandchildren. And then you tell me, well, it's going to be a little bit more than just one conversation with your grandchild. And you tell me about the Gulf Stream and all these things. And I'm on the one hand, I want to see you. You're my friend. And on the other hand, I think if I see Wolfgang, he's going to tell me more stuff that is going to keep me awake at night. But everybody must have felt about that way about you.
That is very true. You enjoy this silent respect and distancing. And it plays out also humorously that colleagues initially said, "Well, I'm having a burger now. I hope that's okay with you, Wolfgang." Which I said, "Yes, of course. Could I have one too? Enjoy your burger." But you become othered in some ways, as if the climate situation was your personal problem.
Yeah.
But the plunge also means learning to swim.
Yeah, and we'll come to the swimming. Is it a kind of valley of helplessness that you have to pass through?
So there, you could also refer to this as a denial, right? We all have denial, and denial is very much part of the human psyche. Without denial, we couldn't function, right? If we were constantly aware of everything that could go wrong, we would be paralyzed. So there's nothing wrong with denial. But I thought that overcoming that denial was a one-time act, that you have this one-time moment after which you become more operable again. And now I realize it has many layers. I would consider myself mostly in denial of what I just have shown on screen. Because what do you even do with that information, right? But then you focus on your area of influence and the things you can do.
Yeah. The email went on. And it said, you know, I worry a little bit about how to talk about this without sounding, well, cultish.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, because if you look at the typical behaviors of cults, is they think to know something no one else does, right? Some sort of higher truth. And of course, there is this moment when you look at that data, and that is very much when I speak with IPCC climate scientists, their sense of alienation from their own world, is that everything feels a bit unfamiliar. And this is why why I was looking for words and engaged with other climate communicators and journalists and people who work in that field and was looking for that community. This is not something I think anyone should try to figure out on their own.
Yeah. So that would be your first advice. Don't do this alone. Do this, but not alone.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also don't change your profession necessarily like I did. I wanted to work on this full time, but what I realize is because it is a systemic challenge, crisis, whatever you want to call it, there is a silver lining to that. It gives you the freedom to do whatever you love, because whichever profession you are in, it needs to be reimagined, re-engineered, reorganized, and you can make a difference right where you are.
Yeah. That last line of the thing I read, you know, it's my moments of fear happen outside that room.
Hmm.
And we've talked about this, I think, in the past. It's like, what will replace denial? I remember you telling me what I fear is not so much climate change, it's what I fear what happens to people once they realize they've been in denial and we're too late.
That is true. That is something I really wonder about is if you work in journalism, which you of course do, and so many of you do, we all have, we believe that transparency is good, that knowledge is good. No matter how uncomfortable it is sometimes, democracy benefits from transparency and knowledge, and I still do. But I wondered in those moments, what kind of resiliency needs to be in place? How strong do societies need to be in their internal cohesion and their shared values to take that blow of realizing what has already happened?
Yeah.
The degree of destabilization, the degree of cost that our societies are beginning to shoulder. And of course, we know that these kinds of crises can trigger extremism, they can trigger all kinds of fundamentalism and a desolidarization. So that is what I meant, is what will this do?
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about masculinity?
Yeah.
Because I think as a man, you're expected to sort of, you can do anything and you feel nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the classic male is the protector and the hunter and no fear. And so you look at images of courageous human beings and they climb buildings, they save the world, they're Bruce Willis, they're Captain America, or they're Jeremy Clarkson and they drive a big petrol car and they love Formula One racing and they eat lots of meat on their own barbecue. And we associate all of that with courage. And what you made me realize is that actually sort of a Hollywood hero is all wrong. Because taking that climate plunge is actually extremely courageous. But it's not at all how masculinity is currently represented.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know about that. I know that I feel safer the closer I am to the fire or the problem. I learned somehow to walk towards what I'm afraid of. But yes, it renders you facing the degree of destabilization we have caused already inevitably causes a high degree of helplessness eventually. But somehow I was wondering when I just listened to you quoting from that email, I feel I'm less afraid now. There has been a phase of mourning what we have lost and what we have destroyed, also the animals we have lost. You know, it's not only climate. We always speak about the twin crisis of biodiversity and climate. It's one and the same thing. But I notice that being able to do whatever, however tiny the thing is I do, helps me balance myself.
Yeah. So denial exacts a higher price ultimately.
That is such an important point. It takes more work to not know and to not look at this than to look at it. And it just like these curves, it takes ever more work to not look at and to not notice that there are fewer insects, fewer birds, compared to when you were a child, and that the weather is so obviously changing. I don't know the data from here, but in the UK, the UK government just announced, it's a story in the Financial Times yesterday, that the rain we have been seeing in the last 18 months is the largest amount since there are records.
Yeah.
And the government also says that, again, not because of climate change, but they gave a figure by how many percent this has been triggered by the climatic changes.
Yeah. Now, in studies about addiction, after denial, there's often anger.
You mean in the Kubler-Ross faces of mourning? Yes, there is an element of rage. That is true.
How do you deal with that?
Fight. Fight. And that is a fight over narratives and perception and information. There is a withholding of hope going on, that nothing is orchestrated, of course, but there is, I really wish that our societies would learn more and hear more about how many solutions are available. The IPCC scientists say, we have the technologies, we have the business methods, and the data to not get us to 2050 net zero, but this mid-step target, the first 20 years, by 2030 to cut our emissions by roughly 45%, we would know how to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is what I learned from you. It's just like, it's far worse than I was hoping, but the solutions are also far closer by than I was thinking.
Yes. That is true. That is true. And I think there are two pieces of information are missing for that really stand in the way. There is no big controversy anymore over whether climate change, if we use the word, is human-made or not. Even in the United States, of course, where we are aware of certain media outlets that say the opposite, in the United States, the percentage of so-called climate science deniers flatlines at 10% since more than 10 years. It's not growing. But the vast majority of the population is very concerned. What populations typically do not know, though, are two facts. One is just how vast the difference is between global warming by 1.5 degrees Celsius versus 2 degrees Celsius, where you think 1.5 to 2 is roughly an increase of 30%. So you think that the adverse impacts of that warming would also be roughly in that range. For insects, though, it's 300% the damage in species loss. For plants, it's about 200%. Or, for instance, for the coral reefs, there is a good chance still for the coral reefs to survive or to recover at 1.5 degree. There's a 99% chance that they will be irretrievably gone if we go to 2 degrees. And again, speaking of denial, I can remember these facts and figures, but rarely ever do I really allow myself to ponder what this means, because coral reefs, for instance, provide jobs to about 300 million people. That's a large amount, tourism, fishery. What the coral reefs also do, though, is they are the nursery to about 25% of all ocean species. What happens if we lose that? Right, your mind always goes into a loop, right? You can't imagine it.
Yeah. And so already now I catch myself thinking how I'm going to get him to stop giving me these facts.
Right. And that is when I mentioned the subtle and not so subtle taboos, of course, nobody wants to speak about these things. I don't. I know what a good dinner party looks like.
Yeah.
And I want to have a good conversation and smile, and that's nothing's wrong with that. And so there are, yes.
So I sometimes struggle with people who I love who are even in even more denial than I am. So I love them, but I also want to smack them.
Yeah, it never works.
No. You tried.
It never works, and it's also really unkind. Yes. I have done it. No, but it. What do you do? What does a doctor do? Not that I'm a doctor, but the scientists are scientists. If we say, please only tell me if you have good news, where would that lead us? And this is why this balance in climate communication between urgency and agency is so important. If a doctor says to you, genetically, you have a chance of 60% of developing a really terrible illness. You will go home, you will give it a thought for a day or two, at least me, maybe because I'm a man, and I will try really hard to imagine myself being part of the 33%.
Yeah.
Right? If the doctor says, and here are the things you can do to get that down to maybe 20%, gives you agency, urgency and agency, you engage. And so that's why this is a better method than hitting people over the head with facts and figures, right?
Yeah.
The other fact that, so one is this 1.5 that I mentioned. It's what this means also, even if we overshoot 1.5 degrees, in the extreme, 2.3 is better than 2.4. Every centigrade matters. That's one. The other one is, I'm sorry, it's a technical term, this carbon budget thing. It's not a holiday budget, but what it means is we can measure the CO2 in the atmosphere. We know by now what it does in warming. And then we can also calculate how many more tons or gigatons we can add before we cross 1.5. And all the chaos we are now seeing is from only having warmed up compared to pre-industrial times by about 1.4 degrees, right? So we can broadly calculate that we have another 400 gigatons we can add. It's estimated that, including the effects of methane, we add about 57 gigatons to the atmosphere per year right now. So that tells you we have less than a decade of being able to continue with the status quo. And this is where all this time pressure comes from, this urgency. And so how is the general public supposed to understand where this net zero thing suddenly comes from and why there's such an urgency if you don't understand that there's a finite time left? So to not add that, this is the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees, and this is how many years we can continue with what we do right now. It's like covering a football game with the goalposts missing. The context is missing. But, you know, when listening to myself right now and having your questions resonate, what you hear is me coping. Right? But what else is there? And I do. I thoroughly enjoy my life. I have a lot of joy. But I also think that you pay a price. You can't unlearn what you learned. But you also get a stronger sense of presence in life and being of your own time. If you look at these facts and figures and spreadsheets.
Because culturally we're both from a Protestant sort of culture, even though we may not be religious. And in Protestantism there's also this, like, thou art nothing. And so I've deeply internalized the idea that, of course, I'm not part of a special generation. Who am I to think that we might be important?
Yes. That's such an important point, because we actually are. And we didn't, no one asked for that. But we are the first group of people that have this odd influence on people who live in 500 years from now or 1,000 years from now. This is a really big thought, but it is true. This has never happened before. Of course, we still are impacted by people who had ideas in places like Amsterdam hundreds of years ago. You last, but our longest lasting legacy, paradoxically, are our emissions, and some of the CO2 sits in the atmosphere for tens of thousands of years. So I do wonder sometimes, it's not my biggest worry, but I do wonder sometimes what they will think about us. You know, what they will call us, what they will call our era. And I think if they're kind, they may call us the sleepwalkers.
Yeah. Going back to that room you were in 2020, 21 April, when we exchanged these emails.
Yeah.
If you could say a few things to the person you were then, what would that be?
Look around. Don't lock yourself away. You can't figure this out on your own, no matter how bright or privileged you are. Speak with people in countries that are already affected by what is happening, because as you know, 4 of the 5 hardest hit countries are in Africa. Africa historically has only contributed something like 4% of historic emissions. And I spoke to journalists from such countries through my work in Oxford later on, and it helped me get more grounded in reality and not speak about future scenarios so much. This is happening right now. And enjoy life. You have to enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
This is not about martyrdom. This is not about punishing yourself. And appreciate the privilege of even having the time to think about this.
Yeah, it's not only happening to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a car here, you said the, what I was lacking in 2001 was agency. So all I got was urgency, urgency, urgency. And that just paralyzed me.
That's very true. I did not foresee. I mean, everybody told me this is the end of your career and, you know, well done you, but subtext, you must be a bit limited in your imagination. And I didn't know I would, you know, be invited by the United Nations and speak to the world's largest corporations. And so I have, of course, I have a lot more agency now. And it gives me hope, and it gives me hope also to see allies and people who care just as much as I do and more in places I didn't expect.
Yeah.
I'm really genuinely inspired by what I see in some of the world's largest corporations as well. There's no such thing anymore as the business community. It is often businesses that push governments to please be more ambitious. As you can see, for instance, in the discussion about combustion engine bans in the EU or the future of e-fuels, where you see former so-called business parties in other European countries think they do the automotive industry a favor by saying, please, we need to stop this combustion engine ban. And some of the largest automotive companies just came out and said to that party, please don't. It's done. We want to shift faster to electric vehicles. These kinds of phenomena.
Yeah.
That I didn't even recognize back then. Yeah.
And so if we would relate it to journalism,
yes,
perhaps we are better at urgency than at agency.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. I think, and there is a so-called solutions journalism movement that comes out of the US, and there's the constructive journalism movement that comes, I think, out of Denmark, that says, yes, cover the news as it is. The first and foremost duty of journalism is to tell it as it is. But that also includes talking about the solutions that exist. And when I did my research initially in Oxford, and I said to many of these very respected climate journalists, what about solutions journalism? They said, that's not our job. That's hope washing. No, hopium is another term.
Hopium.
Hope and hope washing was the one as a subset of greenwashing. And I can understand how that happened. But increasingly also in this moment where we really don't know what the world will look like in 10 years from now. There needs to be also an element of anticipatory journalism of yes, first and foremost, telling it as it is, but then also raising the question of what it could be, how it could look like, because we have to reimagine so many areas of our lives and industries and businesses.
Yeah. I think Lisa Pak is going to talk in detail about how the gaming industry is making these steps.
Yes.
And we will hear much more from you after dinner when we're taking questions from the room. If you could write one sentence in the long-term memory of everyone here, what would that be?
God, he's heavy duty, huh?
Yeah, I didn't give you my questions.
You are at the right place in the right time.
Wolfgang Blau.